This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The EPA has been in the news recently. The agency announced in September that it would limit the amount of carbon emissions on newly built coal and gas-fired power plants. This month, the U.S. Supreme Court said it would hear arguments about the EPA's regulation of greenhouse gas emissions from power plants and other stationary sources. President Obama has used his second term to focus on climate change, and Gina McCarthy, the administrator of the EPA, is leading the charge. While environmentalists support these efforts, coal companies and elected officials from coal-rich states are pushing back. Today on Radio Times, we take a look at the authority and the impact of the EPA, and we have two guests. Erica Martinson is an energy reporter for Politico Pro, where she covers the EPA. Prior to Politico, she spent 5 years following environmental policy and the EPA at Inside Washington Publishers. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, Erica Martinson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Morning. Thanks.
You're welcome. Also with us is John Cushman. He's a contributor to Inside Climate News. He has been a writer and editor in Washington, D.C. since 1978, principally with the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. And Jack Cushman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hello, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here as well. And Jack, if I could begin with you and just a short history lesson, because it is interesting to think that President Nixon signed the EPA into existence back in 1970. And I'm just curious about whether it has always been in someone's crosshairs in these 40 plus years.
Well, one way or another, it has. The EPA was created the year after the first Earth Day. And at the time, it was becoming just increasingly evident to everybody that we needed some kind of unified approach to controlling especially air pollution and water pollution. Remember that the Cuyahoga River caught on fire. It was so polluted, and we used to suffer many days of intense, very uncomfortable and very unhealthy smog in our major cities. And the agency in the past 40 years has taken some really remarkable strides in bringing those kinds of pollution down, but it's a never-ending struggle.
Well, I remember living in Philadelphia in those years. We weren't exactly Beijing, but I do remember, Jack, just frankly how polluted the air was.
Sure. I mean, I inherited old wooden furniture from a Pennsylvania family and spent days scrubbing the coal ash out of the wood surfaces. It just kept coming up like rocks from a Vermont farm.
Does this seem like ancient history to you, Erica?
Well, you know, I'll admit to not being alive when the EPA was founded.
Right.
But that's about it.
But and Jack, if I can just go back to you and just to pick up on something you said earlier, from your perspective, seeing where the EPA started back in 1970, you see real accomplishments on the part of the agency?
Oh, yes, there's no question. You know, there are two things about this agency that have characterized it over the 40 years. One is that it's a science-based agency, and so its regulations are really, by law and in practice, thoroughly grounded in science. And the science has improved as we've learned more about, for example, the effects of small particles of soot and smog on human health. The agency has gradually ratcheted down its standards to make them tighter. And consequently, these pollutants, they've cut many of these pollutants by 10, 20, 30, 40% from where they were a few decades ago, and done so in a way that has demonstrably improved the public's health and saved many tens of thousands of lives.
Well, Erica, talking about today, and clearly the EPA does have its share of critics who believe that the agency sort of over-regulates parts of the industry, including the energy industry. Get us up to speed on what the critics say about the EPA today.
Well, that's certainly true, and it's gotten more and more, you know, tense in Washington over the EPA. And these days, you'll hear over and over again about EPA's war on coal. And as it comes right now, you know, they've gone further and further with pollution regulations, and they're at a point right now, especially when it comes to starting on greenhouse gas regulations, where most of pollution from power plants comes from coal-fired power plants. They start at a very different start line, and so they have a lot more to do to clean up, and it's really pushing hard on the coal industry right now.
Well, and there are several, I guess, coal-related news stories. One, of course, the announcement last month about the EPA's authority, I guess, to regulate the amount of carbon emissions from newly built coal and fire power plants. And, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court picking up on this issue of emissions from stationary plants, which would include power plants. Do you see this as critical issues, Jack?
Yes, indeed. If you're going to do something about the risks of climate change, which the whole world faces, you do have to address the carbon dioxide emissions from coal-fired power plants. A few years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the Clean Air Act does require the Environmental Protection Agency to control carbon dioxide emissions if it finds that those emissions endanger public health and the environment. And the agency made such a finding early in the Obama administration and has been moving since then to begin these regulations, first on automobiles, another main source of carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. and now on power plants of all kinds, starting with new ones and then moving subsequently to existing power plants. So the agency does not, according to the Supreme Court, have a choice about this by law. Now the Supreme Court is going to review under a different section of the law whether the agency automatically has to require stationary sources to have air pollution permits. But in granting that appeal, the Supreme Court made it very clear that it was not going to review the question of whether the Clean Air Act requires CO2 controls, and it was not going to review the question of whether the endangerment finding was appropriately reached. It's going to be a very narrow review, and therefore, in my opinion, is not very likely to affect these new controls on power plants.
How do you see what the court is looking at, Erica?
Well, I would agree. It is a much more narrow issue, and certainly they always have the ability to expand a little beyond, going forward, but a lot of environmentalists cheered this decision by the court to not look retroactively at the rules that EPA has already done other than this one small sliver. And I think they sort of count this as kind of the bumper of the car. With EPA going forward with standards for future and existing power plants, that's really the big game for them. And that's really where you're going to get actual cuts from carbon emissions.
Well, and it's interesting that the world is sort of divided into mobile cars and trucks and things like that, and then stationary things like power plants. Those are critical issues, if I can toss that back to you, Erica, in terms of understanding the authority of the EPA.
Sure. So EPA already went for mobile emissions. They crafted the Transportation Department, what people generally know as fuel economy standards, looking to, far in the future, drive down the amount of greenhouse gas emissions and drive up fuel economy on cars. The next step with power plants, which are actually the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, is really where they have to go if they want to make any significant cuts that could actually impact the state of climate change. But it's a much tougher industry, and people don't get the same. It doesn't get the same public cheering, I think, as upping people's fuel economy on their cars.
Well, and Jack, there is some pushback from these coal rich states. Interestingly, Pennsylvania is one of those states. The attorney general in the state did not want to be part of the numbers of attorneys general who have brought a lawsuit against the EPA. But I assume coal rich states are pushing back because that's one of their sources of revenue.
Yes, revenue, or to put it another way, profit.
Yes.
I would just make a couple of comments about this. One is that there was a tremendous amount of pushback for decades at government regulations to tighten fuel economy or fuel efficiency of automobiles. And it became clear in the past decade or so that technology was available to allow automobiles to get many more miles per gallon of gasoline, and to do so in a way that would save consumers billions of dollars. And yet there was a lot of resistance to this. However, ultimately, when this regulation was negotiated by the EPA, they did get the automobile industry on board, and the industry realized that it was in its own self-interest if it didn't want to see other suppliers of automobiles steal the march on them to embrace these new technologies. And consequently, we now look around and we see cars that get astonishingly yes. higher fuel efficiency coming to the market. Consumers are delighted to have these cars, and as they penetrate the fleet of existing vehicles, we are seeing gasoline consumption actually going down in this country. At the same time that fuel production is going up, gasoline consumption is steadily going down in this country. And so these have economic benefits and consumer benefits, as well as profound health benefits. I would venture to say that ultimately the same thing is going to happen in the electric power generating industry, and that the industry, which is already beginning to embrace new technologies, will continue to do so, and that the style of the EPA in enforcing and promulgating its regulations will be one of collaboration with the industry, always, to be sure, met with the resistance by those for whom the profit motive is very potent. But I don't see any reason to expect that the progress that we've made over the past 30 or 40 years is now going to grind to a halt.
But do you think, Jack, that that power companies, we're speaking broadly here, obviously, but the power companies will see it as in their own best interests, and perhaps even some consumer enthusiasm for these new kind of power plants? Do you see that as part of the scenario?
Well, yes, I don't see why it shouldn't. For example, already we have seen a complete shift in the construction of new power plants to natural gas. This is a mixed benefit, but it is a benefit. It is responsible for a considerable part of the decline in carbon dioxide emissions that this country has achieved over the past 3 or 4 years. Not entirely for that reason, but right. partly for that reason. And so we're already seeing, right now, hardly anybody is proposing to build a new electric power plant that would burn coal, because natural gas at the moment is not just cleaner, but also cheaper. As we see the steady reduction in renewable electricity costs, we're going to see, as we already see, power utilities electing to build wind generation facilities because they outcompete coal on the basis of price.
Well, let's take a very short break, and I do want to get back to our conversation. Eric, I have a couple of questions for you as well. Talking with Jack Cushman, he's a contributor to Inside Climate News. Also with us, Erica Martinson. She's an energy reporter for Politico Pro. And we invited them to join us to talk about the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. As I said at the top of the hour, the EPA has been in the news, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Also taking emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. What's your assessment of the EPA? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Master's Degree in Nonprofit Leadership from the University of Pennsylvania. Now accepting applications for both full and part-time admission. The Nonprofit Leadership Program at Penn. Imagine, achieve, lead. Details at npl.upenn.edu.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in what we hope will be the final few days of the membership campaign here at WHYY. We want to end this drive as much as you do. If you've never been a member of WHYY or you want to renew, pick up the phone and make a pledge of support right now. Your money is invested in programs like Radio Times. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. on newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're getting an update on some of the ins and outs of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And again, our guests are Erica Martinson and Jack Cushman. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Erica, let me go back to you and pick up on a couple of things that we were talking about in the first segment of the show about some of these new technologies having to do with coal. We hear this phrase, clean coal. How should we understand what that means?
Well, it certainly means different things to different people.
I figured.
But if you're asking the EPA, it means coal-fired power plants, and this is what they're proposing for future power plants, capturing the carbon dioxide and either storing it or shipping it elsewhere and keeping it from being emitted into the atmosphere.
Does that technology exist?
It exists, and the big debate is whether or not it is commercially available. There is Southern Company is building a commercial carbon capture plant in Kemper, Mississippi right now. It should be online in the early part of next year, and there are many demonstration projects all over the country and all over the world of varying degrees and different types of carbon capture and storage.
But it's clear that there's some hope and probably investment in this new and evolving technology.
Oh, billions and billions of dollars have been spent on it. And there's this sort of a rock and a hard place where EPA sits, which is, you know, people say, oh, it's not commercially viable. The price hasn't been brought down. But part of the reason is there's really no reason, you know, certainly not for their bottom line, for utility companies to capture carbon if there's no law or regulation mm-hmm. requiring them to do so.
And that's where the EPA comes in.
That's what they're hoping to require.
Let me go back to you, Jack Cushman. And as you understand carbon capture and sequestration, do you see this technology evolving in a speed that would allow us to reduce some of these CO2 emissions?
Well, it's hard to say, and I would suggest that this is not the kind of decision that ought to be made on a command and control basis, absent the an understanding of the market forces that are at work. At the moment, if you were trying to produce, let's call it green electricity that did not add to the problem of climate change, carbon capture is not the first thing that you would do. Hmm. The first thing that you would do would be conservation, because using less electricity by definition gives off less emissions and saves you money. And then there's a whole range of technologies that are available to achieve this purpose, and carbon capture probably is not the one that's there yet. However, it's also a feature of the fight on global warming that someday there's going to have to be a price put on carbon emissions. You can't get the electricity cheap and the pollution for free and preserve the planet and avoid the risks that we confront from global warming. So by either a pollution trading mechanism or a carbon tax, the world is eventually going to move to putting a price on carbon. And if that price is high enough, then carbon capture will be seen as being affordable. It will be an affordable alternative to paying the price on our emissions. And when that happens, this technology would be the life preserver for the coal industry, because without carbon capture and sequestration, the coal is simply going to have to be left in the ground.
Do you think there's a political will, Erica, to support some kind of a carbon tax? That's an issue that's been around for some time now.
Oh, well, there's not political will to pass a budget in Washington right now. So
right.
I think it's pretty unlikely that they're going to move on a carbon tax anytime soon. You know, there was, I think, some hope from some folks for a while that if EPA moved forward with their regulations on existing plants, that would push Congress in that direction to do something that maybe was a little easier to implement or, you know, had a little more of the carrot and less of the stick. But it seems pretty unlikely right now. And, you know, Minority Leader McConnell, Senator McConnell, has pledged to do anything he can to stop EPA from doing these regulations. And he's certainly not talking about carbon tax is a reason to do that.
Let me quote something that was in the New York Times, and it was written by former heads, administrators of the EPA, William Ruckelshaus, Lee Thomas, William Riley, and Christine Todd Whitman, all Republicans. And I'll toss this to you, Jack. They say a market-based approach like a carbon tax would be the best path to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but that is unachievable in the current political gridlock in Washington. And that was written on August 1st. And, of course, we know what we've just been through in the last couple of weeks.
Yes, of course, anybody who follows politics can see that at the moment there is not a consensus or even a drift toward a tax on carbon. And I think it's important to bear in mind that there are many ways to recognize the price on carbon that has to be paid. You know, you're paying it already in the sense that the damages from drought and storm and heat and the health effects of carbon and the other forms of pollution that come out of our smokestacks, you know, these damages have to be paid for, and they are paid for by us as individuals and as a society. Recognizing those costs and putting them back into the transaction of burning fuel is a step that the world is going to have to take if it's going to avoid the risks of further climate change. So someday this is going to happen, and what the mechanism is or what the political dynamic is that gets you there is the question. But, you know, George Shultz, I would add, the Republican Secretary of State and close confidant of Ronald Reagan, is another person who has repeatedly said that we ought to have a carbon tax, and it's almost universally recognized among economists that that would be the most efficient way of achieving our goals, much more efficient than subsidizing green energy, much more efficient than command and control regulations, much more efficient than talking people into being good citizens and driving slower. A carbon tax achieves all these purposes through the power of the marketplace, and it is a tax which can be refunded to the public. It doesn't have to be spent on government programs. It can simply be turned around by the IRS and returned to the public, just therefore encouraging people to conserve electricity almost as a form of tax dodge, which Americans love to do.
Yes, they do. Erica, this is a really wonky question for you, but is cap and trade, is that still around, or what happened to that idea?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, it's in the same place as carbon tax, or probably worse off, I would say, just because those who stopped it fought so hard to make cap and trade a dirty phrase in so many parts of the country. And you know, they're going to have to maybe go in a different direction, or at least just call it something different. If that's the way to go in the future.
Give it a more user-friendly or a name that doesn't have the kind of baggage that has.
Yeah.
Well, I would add another
thought,
Jack. Though. There is, in fact, a successful cap-and-trade program on CO2 emissions in the Northeast under the acronym of REGI. It's working, and it's bringing down pollution, and it's raising revenues for those states. So it's not impossible to get to a cap-and-trade mechanism, as we know perfectly well, because that's how we control acid rain, through the cap-and-trade program on sulfur dioxide that was passed by Republicans and very successfully and at a surprisingly low cost controlled the problem of acid rain, which you never hear about anymore.
No, and Pennsylvania has had a very serious problem of acid rain, in part because of where we're located here. Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you, and that's John Cushman, a contributor to Inside Climate News. He has worked as a writer editor in Washington since 1978, many of those years with the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. Also with us, Erica Martinson. She's an energy reporter for Politico Pro, covers the EPA, and before that, she spent 5 years following environmental policy and the EPA at Inside Washington Publishers. And we're spending this hour putting the spotlight on the EPA, always in the news, always raising a whole host of questions about the environment and health and regulation. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@WHYY.org. Erica, let me go back to you and Gina McCarthy, the new EPA administrator. And it seems that President Obama began his second term being a little more proactive, perhaps, on this whole notion of climate change. Do you see a different EPA this year?
Well, no. You know what? I would say that perhaps President Obama began this administration a little more upfront about how EPA is tackling climate change, because as Jack mentioned earlier, they put this into play and they started the ball rolling, so to speak, in 2009, as soon as Obama got into office. And this was always sort of the next step that's been coming, and now they've just gotten there. As to go back to cap and trade just for a second, as you mentioned, EPA actually today kicks off some of its public meetings about the existing plant rule for greenhouse gases that they're working on right now. They want to propose it next summer. And that is part of, programs like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast states that allow cap and trade. That's one of the things they're really considering as part of this rule. They'll put out some guidelines and maybe some sort of a limit, and states will have to find ways to cut greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. And one of those ways, most likely, is going to be that different states are going to be able to create their own types of cap-and-trade programs or their own sort of energy efficiency programs. Depends on how they want to go about it. Depends on their energy mix. But that's sort of the other, backdoor side of cap-and-trade. These rules.
And let me just underscore something that you said, and I'll toss this to you, Jack, which is that the existing power plants that we have today, the largest source of CO2 emissions, is that correct?
Certainly 30%, I believe. The number may be 40%, depending on how it's measured, of greenhouse gas emissions are coming from that sector. And therefore, you can't really address the problem of greenhouse gases without limiting those emissions, and because we're on a course to limit our national emissions by 17% by the year 2020, that's mm-hmm. right around the corner,
yes.
and 50% or 80% by the year 2050. These are very steep reductions that have to be made under our international commitments, and therefore cannot be made without this sector's involvement. Now, one of the things I think maybe some listeners may not be entirely sure what cap and trade even means. To put it simply, if everybody's pollution is controlled at certain limits, but you can do a deal with somebody else to exceed their targets and let you off the hook a little bit, then the marketplace can allow us all to choose those mechanisms which are cheapest and most effective, rather than going with a blunderbuss approach, which requires everybody to spend money on what can be extremely costly approaches. And so cap and trade is a kind of trading game that is intended to get the most possible emission reductions at the lowest possible price. And it's been proven fairly effective, not as effective as a carbon tax, but
right.
pretty effective at steering people in the right directions.
Do you think, Erica, and we're almost up on the year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, as we call her here in the Delaware Valley, that the impact of Sandy has in any way changed the conversation about the Environmental Protection Agency?
It's funny you say that. On the anniversary of Superstorm Sandy next week, there's a large group of coal groups holding a protest at the Capitol against EPA regulations, and the House Energy and Commerce Committee is holding a hearing about how EPA regulations are ruining the coal industry. So to the degree of changing the conversation in Washington, I would say probably not at all. They're fallen into two camps at this point of folks who feel like that's a symbol or a side of climate change that needs to be dealt with, and those who go in a different direction.
What do you think? Yeah, I'd be curious about your take, Jack, and then we'll get to some of our callers.
Right. Well, I think it depends on whether you view the intense partisan divide that has gripped Washington for the past 5 or 10 years as being an anomaly or as being the new course that our government is going to live with throughout the rest of our lives. I would just remind people that, environmental protection has been a bipartisan cause And the main environmental statutes that we live with have passed Congress by enormously wide margins on a bipartisan basis and been signed and enforced by Republicans and Democrats alike. There was a brief, embarrassing period during the Reagan administration when a couple of dozen top EPA officials had to resign, including the
James
administrator
White.
And the Superfund director. It was a scandalous time in the agency's history, but they brought Mr. Ruckelshaus back. He had been the first EPA administrator. They brought him back. He was a very solid responsive and responsible public official. He was a party to the Saturday Night Massacre, another anniversary that we're celebrating here.
Yes, indeed.
He came back, and they got the ship righted, and the agency continued with its mission. And all the time, there's been really widespread public support for clean air, clean water, safe drinking water, and removing lead. I mean, think of the achievement of reducing lead, which damages our brains and our children's brains, and compromises their intellect. And reducing that by 99% is really a remarkable, very profound achievement for the country. It's raised our national IQ. And so this has enjoyed widespread bipartisan support, and some of that support still lingers. It's the toxic divisiveness of our current political setup that is causing disarray. And I tend to believe that we're going to find our way out of this and return to a more bipartisan mode at some time in the future.
Well, we're about a minute away from our second break here, but Erica, going back to you, and as you can imagine, we've done a lot of shows about the impact of Sandy, and one of the things that we have learned is that there is measurable sea level rise. Now, that might not sound as bad as the air in Beijing, but nonetheless, it seems that has enormous implications for building, for infrastructure, all those issues as well.
Oh, of course. I mean, so much of the American population actually lives on the coast. And so that's obviously going to become a big deal going forward. And I think that that's something that a lot of folks think will maybe change the conversation on climate change, in addition to perhaps moving past this state of permanent anger going on in Washington, is that, certain states, particularly, in the South and Florida and a lot of these coastal states are going to see serious impacts, Miami in particular, in New Orleans, again,
sure.
Because they're losing coastline, sea levels are rising, and it causes more intense storms, and that's a serious issue to contend with.
And that's Eric Martinson, energy reporter for Politico Pro. Also with us, Jack Cushman, contributor to Inside Climate News, and we do want to get some callers in on the conversation. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We're talking about some of the ins and the outs of the Environmental Protection Agency. We'll be right back.
LaSalle University offers a master's program in translation and interpretation that addresses three main environments: business, legal, and healthcare, where translation and interpretation involving English and Spanish is currently needed and will continue to be in the future. Details at 215-951-1100 or lasalle.edu/Hispanic Institute. The Hispanic Institute at LaSalle University supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This morning on Radio Times, FixingHealthcare.gov, that's the federal government's healthcare exchange that's been experiencing so many problems. Then a look at the EPA with two journalists who cover the agency. We keep you in the know here at Radio Times. What's that worth to you? $10 a month, $20 a month? You decide and then make this phone call. It's 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks.
Build-A-Bridge International supports WHYY and will host their Hopeful City Gala at WHYY on November 9th to highlight the role of art and creativity in child wellness and development. The gala will feature interactive art making and an auction of artwork created by the region's political, religious, corporate, and cultural leaders. The artwork presents a collective vision for a more hopeful city where children can grow and develop. Information and tickets at hopefulcity.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the history, impact, and authority of the EPA with Erica Martinson and John Cushman, or Jack Cushman. And again, we've got an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Henry from, looks like, Marlton, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Henry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to know if the EPA is considering zero-point energy as a solution to climate change.
Zero-point energy? Can you answer that, Jack?
I'm not familiar with the term.
Oh, well, what does that mean, Henry?
I'm not 100% sure on the details of it. I'm not a scientist or anything like that, but
right. Pretty
much it just uses magnetism and gravity to it's like a gyroscope. You start spinning it, and it just starts producing more energy than you put into it, and it's basically free energy.
Can you answer that, Erica?
Yes. Though I'm not familiar with the term either.
Right, me neither.
And EPA doesn't dictate necessarily what type of, you know, where we get our energy. That's up to the utilities, and EPA can require that they don't emit a certain amount of pollution, or that that they cut their carbon to certain levels. But they don't create energy or require that companies produce it from a certain type of fuel. So probably not.
No,
okay. I understand.
Okay, Henry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jack, let me ask you, what do you make of Gina McCarthy? She's been on the job not quite a year as the administrator. What do you make of her approach, her philosophy, her personality?
Right. I would make a couple of comments. One is that she is, because she was in charge of the agency's air programs, you know, the agency covers air, water, and radiation and other toxics, she is very familiar, steeped in the ins and outs of air quality regulation, and so perfectly qualified to take on this very tough job in terms of her background. Secondly, she is not a partisan. She worked for Governor Romney in Massachusetts, I've forgotten what other Republican governor she worked for in another state. Maybe Erica can help me out there. So she is not a partisan. Her style of regulation is very much consultative. And so she is, this is not just a dog and pony show in which she's consulting starting today with the public on the development of regulations for existing power plants. She is genuinely interested in coming to a solution, as the agency did with the automotive side, that will satisfy the legitimate needs of the industry. And for all of those reasons, I think she is really typical of a long line of EPA administrators. Ruckelshaus, Russell Train, I mean, there have been Bill Riley, there have been many very capable and proficient regulators at the EPA. And I think she's one in that long line.
And Erica, how is she seen in Congress, for instance?
You know, I think she's actually largely fairly well-liked. People consider, whether they agree with her or not, they consider her a very straightforward person. She has sort of a no-nonsense kind of demeanor, although she's actually fairly funny as well. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the governor she worked for as well in Connecticut, but she headed up Connecticut's environmental program. And from that place, she comes from heading up state environment programs, and so I think she is sensitive to the concept of EPA coming in and telling states what to do, and how much states don't like that and want to work in a collaborative partnership, you know, dealing with what their individual problems are, and come to sort of a consensus.
And Eric, I'm always curious about the relationship between the EPA and the Department of the Interior. And there's a relatively new head of the Department of the Interior, Sally Jewell. Do they have a largely collaborative relationship? Do you know?
I don't think that they always overlap that much in their certainly they cover some of the same issues, but the statutes and the way they employ things aren't necessarily overlapping most of the time. So I would say that they are probably on the same team, but I don't think they work together a great
different
deal.
Responsibilities. Let me see what it looks like Tom from Bluebell has to say. And Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Good.
I have a question. I was wondering what the EPA, what do they see? Do they see their role as strictly as an advocate for the environment against everything else, or do they feel like do you feel like it's your job to actually weigh the cost of your regulations? I'm thinking a couple minutes ago you mentioned the coal industry, and I'm thinking, I'm guessing that most of the people at the EPA think of coal as something that needs to disappear. But, you know, if it does disappear, the average person in the United States might end up paying 30% more for electricity, which might not hit your guests too hard. But some, you know, a single mom who's raising a kid and has their electric bill goes up 30%, that has a real impact. And I wonder if they factor those real impacts, cost of these regulations in.
Yeah, Tom, and I'm sure there are people at the EPA that want to figure out how to manage the coal that we rely on, but let me see what Jack Cushman has to say. Does the EPA take the cost of regulation into effect?
Yes, indeed. I personally recall when I covered the imposition of the smog and soot rules during the Clinton administration, I asked Carol Browner, who was then the administrator, if I could take her picture standing next to the cost-benefit analysis document, which I was sure would be a very big document.
Yes.
And it turned out it was such a big document, it took up about 70 linear feet of shelf space, and so we couldn't manage that picture. They do exhaustive cost-benefit analyses. And I read recently a study of all EPA regulations since its founding, and all the pollution regulations, and then the study examined all the effects on the industries that were governed by these regulations. And it came out that the costs of these regulations expressed as a percentage of the industry's profits came to a little under 10%. So that's not an insignificant cost on an industry. If you say your profits are going to be cut 10%. By the cost of these burdensome regulations. On the other hand, you need to factor in the savings from these. And that same single mother whose electricity bill goes up might be the mother of an asthmatic child. And we know that air pollution causes severe problems for asthmatic children. It's very costly to care for an asthmatic child. And the EPA's regulations are estimated easily to have prevented 200,000 premature deaths over the past several years. It's on the range of 10,000 premature deaths a year that are prevented. And the regulations have quantifiable benefits to society that also run into the tens of billions of dollars. So these things are studied. They're examined very closely. And I think any reasonable examination that I've ever seen of this question has found that the benefits of our having cleaned up our air over the past 40 years profoundly exceed the cost that we've had to pay for that.
Tom, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me pick up on what he said, Erica. The idea that the Environmental Protection Agency works for environmentalists or environmental organizations, that it's sort of chosen that side. I think that's a belief that a lot of people have. Is it true?
Well, I mean, their job is to protect the environment, and human health really is the huge driver. But, you know, to some degree, EPA they're implementing laws passed by Congress, and they're certainly required to take into account costs, and that's certainly something they consider. I think something we probably haven't talked about much during this time that's a really big issue for all this that's been a big change for EPA and also a problem for the coal industry is the explosion of the natural gas industry in America. Over the last 5 years or so, which almost no one would have predicted, you know, changes to technology for fracking have opened up the Marcellus Shale and frankly made Pennsylvania more of a natural gas state than a coal state now. And a lot of what's hitting the coal industry and utilities switching, they're switching to natural gas. They're not, if they're abandoning coal, they're moving to a different American-made fossil fuel. You know, that's an economic problem for the coal industry. It's a benefit for EPA as they try to find ways to cut carbon emissions because coal plants are double the CO2 emissions, roughly, of a natural gas plant.
And what I've heard, Jack, is the many sort of coal supporters, I would say, industry supporters, blame environmentalists for the alleged attacks on coal, when really it is the natural gas industry that is stealing customers away.
Oh, I think it's perfectly fair to say that the environmental movement is determined to reduce the nation's use of coal unless the carbon is can be captured or offset, because the environmental movement is committed to reducing the risks that we face from greenhouse gases, and carbon dioxide is the principal greenhouse gas, and coal is the principal source of our carbon dioxide emissions. So I wouldn't think that any environmentalist would be apologetic about seeking to minimize the use of dirty coal in producing electricity. The Sierra Club has a whole campaign geared to doing just that. Mayor Bloomberg of New York is totally committed to reducing the use of coal. And the reason is that it is, by any objective standard, a dirty fuel.
Let me, we haven't talked about the Keystone Pipeline. I know that's in many ways under the Secretary of State or the Department of State, but if I can go back to you, Erica, that seems to be the big kind of question mark, which is what is the Obama administration going to decide about the Keystone Pipeline? Do you have any feel or any readings about what direction they're going in?
Well, I'm not a betting woman.
Good for you.
So I'm not necessarily sure exactly where they're going to come down. But if you want to look at EPA's interaction on that, I mean, they've definitely, in a recent letter they wrote, you know, this spring, on the draft environmental impact statement that the State Department was doing, they weren't wildly enthusiastic, but they didn't really take the opportunity to condemn it. They said they didn't have enough, they had insufficient information, and they basically set up a way for the State Department to go forward that they, you know, listed a few things they thought they could change, get commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions from TransCanada and address a few other issues that kind of gave the State Department a route forward for saying yes to the Keystone Pipeline.
Interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Erica Martinson. Also with us, Jack Cushman, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Jack, the same question to you. I mean, this is the, you know, it seems like a decision that is hanging over this administration. What do you think they're going to do?
I can't possibly guess what they're going to do.
Right.
President Obama, if you recall the rope-a-dope defensive boxing style that Muhammad Ali once used.
I do remember
that. It was to hang on the ropes and duck and weave. And I think that's where the Obama administration has found itself with this very difficult issue. As far as the EPA goes, the most telling comment that they made to the State Department after that environmental impact statement came out, I think, was to say that, look, State Department, you have to recognize that this pipeline is going to produce over its lifetime something on the order of a billion tons of extra CO2 compared to cleaner forms of petroleum, you know, compared to the average petroleum that this country refines, and that a billion tons of CO2 may be small compared to the 6,000 billion tons of CO2 that the U.S. gives off every year, or the 30,000 billion tons of CO2
Wow.
that the world gives off, but every ton counts, and you cannot make a decision on this matter without taking into regard the actual emissions that would result from importing these tar sands. Now, the State Department has to make what's not just an environmental decision, but a national interest decision. And since the days when this pipeline and the tar sands expansion in Canada were first dreamed up in the early days of the Bush administration, our energy situation has profoundly changed. We're now the world's leading supplier of energy. We're going to soon be a net exporter of petroleum products, including crude petroleum if it's allowed. And our domestic production of oil and gas are going up, and our demand is going down, and our greenhouse emissions consequently are going down. So there's a real serious question whether we as a nation really need this Canadian oil. It's a very attractive option for Texas refineries to refine that oil and to export the product, but it's not clear to what extent this is in the nation's interest.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and final question to you, Erica. So, look, any, I guess, big issues? Well, we've got the U.S. Supreme Court that's going to be looking at some of the regulatory authorities of the EPA. Is that the big issue that you'll be watching for?
Sure. I mean, you know, as it turns out, there's actually quite a few things going on at the EPA that greenhouse gas regulations are new to, you know, the last few years, but they're still regulating quite a few other things. So they've got other issues for power plants and other issues for coal and gasoline and different types of ozone standards. And they've got another fight for several other air pollutions that are headed into court right now. So
much on the table.
A lot coming up.
Well, Erica Martinson, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's energy reporter for Politico Pro. Jack Cushman, thank you very much as well.
Glad to be here.
And Jack is a contributor to Inside Climate News. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including a Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, email, archives. I'm Marty Moscowane and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. Thank you so much for joining us.